Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 316 of the podcast. It's Saturday, 8th of April, 2017, as I record this on a glorious day in sunny Bath. The blossom is out and the fat squirrels are running around the park, and I'm looking forward to a long walk along the canal tomorrow, it's just going to be so nice. It's one of after living in Australia for nearly 5 years, I really appreciate the seasons in Britain, because we lived in Brisbane and it's pretty much either hot and dry or hot and wet. So I love the progression of the seasons, and the blossom right now is gorgeous. So yes, I'm feeling very happy, and I have some personal news that has also made me very happy this week, which I shall tell you in a minute. But today I have an interview with Thad McElroy, and we totally geek out on futuristic stuff, including AI, machine learning, and the bestseller code, algorithms and author branding, startups, quantum computing, and the future of publishing. And we have a lot of fun, and I really love Thad. And even though we're quite different in terms of our age and our culture and our experience in the world of publishing, we actually have a very similar mind, and we are quite giggly together. It's quite funny. And we love this stuff. So listen on if you fancy checking all that out. So before I get into my personal update, publishing news this week, I think the most interesting thing that's happened this week is the launch of Amazon Cash. Again, Amazon's always bringing out new things, but this is really interesting because this is essentially aimed at, supposedly by the article, 7% of US households don't have bank accounts. And creating a service like Amazon Cash could help people underserved by banks or without credit or debit cards to shop online. Now, I think this is, yes, it will reach some of those people. But I also think that along with the purchase of Souq.com, which I announced last week in the Middle East, and also Amazon's development in India, many households outside of Western countries don't have bank accounts or debit or credit cards. So I actually think this is a technology play for those other markets more than the US. So very interesting, and something that I think will help the development of digital sales in other countries. So fascinating. So that I think is probably it for publishing news this week. Let's talk about my own personal update. So big news. It was announced that I'm a finalist in the final five for the International Thriller Writer Awards in the Best Ebook Original category for my thriller Destroyer of Worlds. Now, this is such a big deal. And I wrote a blog post yesterday about why this means so much. And I thought I would talk a bit about it because the validation of being put in this finalist group. Now, whether or not I win, this is still a big deal. And I was trying to think about why. I mean, literally, this is the biggest thing to happen to me as an author. You know, when I hit the New York Times and USA Today lists, I was slightly disappointed, weirdly, because those lists are not bestseller lists. Those are gameable lists that are, you know, and everyone will say that, yes, it's a game. And if you play the game, you can make it. I played the game and made it. But I didn't feel happy about it. You know, I use the titles because everyone else does. And why not? My game is just as valid as anyone else's. But this award, this is not a game. This is the International Thriller Writers is the premier organization for thriller writers, and primarily in the US, but also internationally. It is run by some of the biggest names in thriller writing, including people like Lee Child. There's a lot of authors there who I really highly respect, and the awards are judged by writers. So basically there's a, you know, everyone submits their books, and that includes publishers submitting their books. And as an author, you are allowed to submit your book, but really only for that ebook. The ebook category. But the awards, you know, in the past have gone to, you know, names as big as, you know, Stephen King and Lee Child and people like that. So pretty excited. I will be sitting on a table near one of my favorite authors, Jonathan Mabry, who's also on the shortlist for best paperback original novel with Killswitch. So the awards are dominated by traditional publishers. Interestingly, Amazon's Thomas and Mercer has a couple in the paperback original bracket, and up against me on the ebook original is James Scott Bell, who's been on the show before, also Sean Black, who's an indie, and a couple of other people. But basically this means a lot to me because it is for writing. It's nothing to do with sales. Other authors read all the submissions, then they come up with this shortlist. So I'm in the shortlist of five. And then the shortlist goes to a group of even more senior writers, senior being authors who've been doing this a long time, and they judge who wins. And it's a bit like the Oscars in that we all go to this big gala dinner and on the Saturday night of Thriller Fest in New York in July. And then they open an envelope and they read out the name. So there are a number of reasons why this is so important to me and why I'm just over the moon about it. So first of all, is that validation? Because, you know, one of the amazing things about being an indie author is that there are no gatekeepers and anyone can write and publish. But of course, that means that our validation has to come from our own internal happiness about a creative project, which is absolutely brilliant, but also from book sales and from customer reviews. We rarely get validation from in the traditional ways. Now, of course, I should have all the validation I need. You know, I do well with my books, I get good reviews, I feel like I write decent enough books. But, you know, I'm very honest in this blog post, and, you know, I crave the validation that I can actually write. I want to be on the same level as these very famous traditionally published authors. I want to be that good. I want someone to say, you're good enough, you deserve to be here, rather than, you know, being on the outside looking in. That doesn't mean necessarily I want a traditional publishing deal, but I want to be judged as a gooder writer as some of my peers. And, you know, in the blog post, I share a picture of me with Ian Rankin, who's a very big British crime author, Chelsea Kane, who's awesome American crime thriller writer, and Lee Child. And I've also got, you know, a lot of pictures with many of my writing sort of heroes. And I would love to be as well loved as they are. I think that is the point. So this prize, this award, is something that is judged on writing, not on marketing and business skills. Because so many people have said to me, oh, you're only successful because you're good at marketing and business. And I'm like, oh, well, that, you know, I have learned marketing. I don't have any training in marketing as such before I became an author. But you know, I am a businesswoman. So yes, I'll accept that that's true in part, but I want to be known for my stories, and I work just as hard at my craft. I do courses. In fact, Destroyer of Worlds, and I've put a link to it in the blog post, I did the Depth in Writing course from Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Rush just before this book. So that writing course really helped me, and I highly recommend it to everyone. You can find it at deanwesleysmith.com/online-workshops. And I'm going to have Dean back on the show in a couple of months' time, so that'll be good. But yeah, the Depth in Writing helped me so much, and essentially I became a better writer. Destroyer of Worlds is my 12th novel. So that might tell you a bit about how much practice I was doing. But you know, me getting to be a finalist, and you never know, might even win. I feel like I'm one step closer to being a better writer. Also, there's potential career opportunity. So, you know, there are agents there. There are, you know, lots of possibilities once you're seen in the industry as someone who can actually write a book. And then there's my ego. And I wanted to completely put it out there that this is a big ego boost. It's also really helped my confidence as a fiction author. I'm pretty confident in many ways, but I think like many authors, I balance chronic self-doubt with trying to be self-confident, or at least trying to portray that. Those of you who've read The Successful Author Mindset realize that I have just as much fear and self-doubt as anyone else, but hey, I can fake it. But yeah, this means a lot to me. So I wanted to tell you guys about it. One, there's no humble bragging here. This is clearly bragging. But also to feel that, you know, put it out there that this is one of my goals. And I really, really want to win this. I want to hold that trophy so that I can feel I am a decent writer, judged by my peers. I know, of course, many people have emailed me. It's so funny, and said, you know, I really like the sound of your books, but I don't like scary books, so I'm not going to read them. So this is the thing, you know, the thriller writers are my peeps, because we get it. We get the dark side of things. So yeah, that's why this means so much to me. And I want to thank you all for being part of my author journey. Those of you who've been listening for years, I mean, even I started podcasting before I even wrote fiction. You know, the podcast started in 2009 when I didn't even consider writing fiction. So it's been a hell of a journey, and many of you have come along with me the whole way. So, I mean, exciting. Where should we go in the next 7 years? That is the question. But this is something that means a lot. And the announcement will be on Saturday, 15th of July, 2017. So I will obviously be on Twitter that night, you know, whether I win or not, because if James Scott Bell or Sean Black win, I will mind a lot, but I will celebrate them because they're cool. So, but it is certainly an interesting time. So anyway, that's my personal news. And I'm pretty happy about that. And I'll be representing the indies for sure. In terms of writing this week, I've done updates on the co-writing book, which you'll be able to get as a bonus if you buy American Demon Hunter's Sacrifice in launch week. And I'll be telling you more about that next week when it actually launches. So yes, the book is launching on April 17th, which will be next week. We've written a whole new chapter based on the four author collaboration, and also added quotes from people. And again, that book includes a private writing diary that Jay, well, it was private until we put it in a book. So the collaboration, co-writing and collaboration book is going to come back out soon. And it will also be out in print for those of you who've been wanting it in print. I've also been editing the latest Sweet Romance. Now, you know, again, a number of people, after I told you all I was doing this because of a family situation, you know, people have written to me and said they're glad I'm not selling out by attempting to write in a genre I don't really read. And I've been reflecting on the whole Sweet Romance thing, because I don't think it's a sweet romance, but one of my favourite movies is Legends of the Fall, which is, I think, a more maybe a love story. It's quite tragic in many ways, but certainly romance in many ways. And I also just read Strange the Dreamer by Lainey Taylor, which I highly recommend, and also the Daughter of Smoke and Bone series, which is amazing. That's basically a fantasy romance, and I love that book. I raced through it. It's awesome. So I think I do read in the romance genre, but a lot darker. So I'm very interested in seeing where that goes. I mean, the sweet romance that I'm doing with this family member who I'm trying to help is definitely sort of small town sweet romance. And I'm enjoying editing it. I feel very happy that I can help, and I'm satisfied with the story elements, and I'm learning a lot about structure. So it's definitely a different experience, and I will be proud of the result, but I'm desperate to get back to my own JF Penn writing. So I will be working on that for a couple more weeks, and then getting back to the next JF Penn. And I really want to get back to the matte books, but I need to write
a New Orleans book because that's still fresh in my head. So much to do. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Amy Shazari says, I changed my shopping day to Monday so I can listen to your latest podcast as I drive there and back. I'm also able to shop Mondays because I'm now a full-time author and I can do whatever I want whenever I want. And she's very excited about that. Congratulations, Amy. And she also sent me a picture of her costume from last Halloween in the pet cemetery, which is awesome. Rose Arrowsmith DeCue says, dusting is better with the podcast, and sent a cute picture. Very cute duster, Rose. Oh, Richard said he took action on the Amazon ads replay of the webinar I did with Mark Dawson and found a new highest performing keyword, and says this goes to show that items in the news can help promote books. I added the yearly tournament schedule list and past winners as keywords to make my list more evergreen. That's a really good tip from Richard. I've actually done the same. Like, I've kept an eye on which thriller books are being promoted by traditional publishing, and when people search for that, they will hopefully also find my book. So definitely keeping an eye on things that are in the news. Lou Blazer says, the show with Brian Cohen is super. The bit about how to do networking is great, even though this introvert can struggle with that. So that's cool. Stephen Moore says, fab podcast with Brian about funnels and relationships. My wife is a writer too and gets it, which is amazing. And remember that you can join Brian and me for our free webinar this coming Thursday, 13th of April at 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK. And we'll be going through selling for authors, a number of tips on funnels and networking and other things. So check that out at thecreativepen.com/Brian17, BRYAN17. And you can also get the replay if you're busy over Easter weekend. Tony Walsh, who's the author of A Guide to Oman, said about Amazon and souk, the potential is vast, over 100% smartphone penetration in the Gulf, which I presume means people own more than one phone each, wealthy national and many expat residents. I agree. I think the souk purchase is a big play, and to grow the digital sales percentage in those other markets. And finally, Brittany Fichter said, potty training in preparation for baby number two while I listen. The podcast on needing time for a career was so needed here. And what I love about Brittany is she's been tweeting me since she had her first baby. So we're just growing up with the show. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Como Writing Life, and I'll play a word from them in a minute. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Brecht from write2k.com, Carl A. Rosser, Cameron J. Quinn, and Susan Moore. And thanks to everyone who's been supporting the show since I first launched the Patreon. I really appreciate everyone who supports the show, like the tweets and emails. It really demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And if you want to support the show with just a couple of dollars a month, coffee or two a month, you'll get an extra Q&A, a monthly audio, which I do, which I'm about to record next week for April. And you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on to the interview.
Hello, creatives. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Author Relations at Kobo. Because you're a creative Pen listener, chances are you already know Kobo is a global company. But did you know that Kobo has merchandisers around the globe creating unique web store views in major global territories? Did you know that we have special features on local authors in those territories? Similarly, the top 50 bestseller lists and the category rankings on Kobo are unique. So we have about 17 different bestseller lists. And due to recent improvements on Kobo.com, you can actually see how your book is ranking in a territory other than the one you live in. So if you're looking at your book on Kobo, what you want to do is go to the very top and click on the country flag, which will probably be showing the country that you were viewing our website from. And that will bring you to a page that basically allows you to check from 18 plus different countries. So if you're an American, you can see what your book looks like in Canada. If you're in the UK, you can see what your book looks like from Australia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is handy because it can help show you what your currency looks like so you can take advantage of our ability to set prices in 18 different currencies. But you can also see, if you happen to be selling really, really well in those territories, just how well you're ranking there. That's just one of the improvements we've been making at Kobo. We're going to be making more. You can find more tips like this at KoboWritingLife.com. Looking forward to seeing you there. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Today, I'm back with Thad McElroy. Hi, Thad.
Hi, Joanna. How are you?
I am good. And it's so great to have you back on the show. It's been over 18 months since you were on the show in July 2015. And a lot's changed in the future of publishing, hasn't it?
It certainly has. Yeah. Thank gosh for that. It's very interesting for all of us.
So we have a lot to talk about, but just a little introduction. Thad is a journalist, author, speaker, and publishing consultant specializing in the future of publishing. And he actually has the website Future of Publishing, which is just amazing. I mean, it's such a good URL. So we're going to start straight away with publishing and machine learning. We've both read The Bestseller Code, Anatomy of the Blockbuster Novel by Jodi Archer and Matthew Jockers, which came out last year. And you wrote a blog post on it, several actually. So I wanted to know, what are your thoughts on how publishers are using or will be using machine learning in this kind of bestseller way?
Good question. Tough question. So you're starting off with maybe the toughest one, because it's complicated on a couple of sides. On the one hand, we have to get some definitions out of the way right away. Mm. I've been talking to some colleagues a lot about this the last few weeks. We all say artificial intelligence, and artificial intelligence then makes them think about IBM's Watson computer taking on and winning in chess and in Go, and you think about Google's language translation, some really heavy duty technologies that are reliant on something that could be described as AI. On the other hand, much of what people are referring to when they say AI is more pedantic or down-to-earth or simpler technologies, such as being able to crunch through 10,000 novels and try and find a repeating word pattern in there. And there's no sort of intelligence per se, other than the programmer who put the thing together. You're really using the horsepower of a lot of computers that you can access through things like Amazon's web service. And at the same time, what you're accessing that's new is these, what they call corpuses, these large databases of text information, of demographic information. And you go in and you can crunch things that we didn't have the power to crunch before, and we didn't have the information that was worth crunching. And so for people who want to get a handle on this, I'd really recommend their first step is to go to Wikipedia, and start with artificial intelligence, get a little handle on how that's defined, and keep a skeptical eye on some of the more grand claims about it. But then go to machine learning, go to NLP, natural language processing, text mining, and see what the definitions of those are. And think that through, because if you want to understand what the opportunity is for the book publishing industry and self-published authors, it has to be something that's some more nitty-gritty than some nefarious magical AI cloud type of thing.
I was going to say that the natural language processing, I think, is what is interesting, because of course as writers we're always thinking about what word to use in this way. And as you say, all they did really was tell a database, to pull out emotional words and where they were in a percentage of the book and say, you know, The Da Vinci Code and 50 Shades of Grey had the same emotional journey, even though they're completely different books. So as you say, how intelligent is that? And I guess from an author perspective, should we be looking at books like The Bestseller Code and trying to reverse engineer, or should we just kind of go, you know, whatever, and just carry on writing what we love?
Yes, exactly. It is intriguing. And again, you know, I guess we want to recommend to people that they pick up The Bestseller Code. It's a fascinating book. And the authors are scientists. They're both PhDs in their subject area. And they have done truly extensive research in building the book. So, you know, when I first heard about the book, I thought it was going to be by, you know, two people who just saw an opportunity to take advantage but didn't really know their stuff. These folks really know their stuff. And again, you know, some of the technologies I was just talking about, they have an appendix to the book that gives a pretty good description of how to apply these technologies to the analysis of manuscripts. So they took, as I recall, about 5,000 best-selling books. Mm-hmm. And went in and tried to find things like such as you're saying, emotional arcs within certain kinds of words. The one that always amused me was that you have a better chance of a bestseller if there's a dog than a cat in there. It's one of the things they counted up. So with all of those things, then they were able to come up with a fairly elaborate description of the kinds of components that you would find in these best-selling books. They claim about an 80% accuracy. And so then when it came to the obvious question, okay, should an author follow the formula? Mm-hmm. They're very clear that that's not what they're suggesting. And yet, as I noted in my blog post, they may say they're not saying that. I think they're really, you know, sort of covering their behinds on that sense, because in fact, it is quite prescriptive. Mm. It's very prescriptive as to the types of things that authors should do if they want to get these kind of a best-selling structure. However, our last thing on that is, you know, as I was reading that through, I was thinking, gosh, this could be any of dozens of books on, you know, how to write a great novel, how to write compelling fiction, how to create great characters. It didn't seem at that level all that extraordinary.
Mm. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Like, for example, I think they said something like shorter sentences, you know, will mean, yeah. And it's like, well, yeah. And that's kind of, that's one of the things that people tell you. And yeah. Right. So, but anyway, I thought it was a really interesting book, and reading it made me think more. And in fact, machine learning in general, of course, Amazon's algorithm is a machine learning thing that we don't know how it works, but people make educated guesses every single day. Yes, and last time we talked about how hopefully the book itself will be metadata. That hasn't happened yet, unfortunately. I hope it does at some point. But one of the things that a lot of authors are asking me is, should we be, as authors, trying to make sure the algorithm can tell what type of books we write and the audience we have? So I have two author names, Joanna Penn, who writes nonfiction for authors, and JF Penn writes thrillers. So it used to be like, yes, that's a branding thing for covers and everything. But now, is this a big data thing where we should be trying to educate the algorithms with very clear distinctions? And is that something that we're going to see more of?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And that's really the heart of the matter in many ways. Let's start with the thing that you and I enjoy, the idea of the book as metadata, which, you know, I think we're the two holders of that idea. And it's an intriguing sense, right, that if we can abstract a title, a short description of a book, then surely if we can delve in with machine power to the whole book, we can extract a tremendously larger set of information. You know, of course, with nonfiction, it's easier. But even with fiction, I mean, you can pick up themes, you can pick up locales, you can pick up, you know, types of activities. Blah, blah, blah. And that is a metadata abstraction from the book. What I've seen since then is I spent some time trying to understand how Google Scholar works. Mm. And Google Scholar is, people think that it's an extension of the Google search engine, but in fact, it's a separate technology. It was built in a different way, using different kinds of software to detect responses to queries. Google Scholar does surface a lot of books, generally not fiction, but what Google Scholar insists on in order to quickly surface a piece of information is that there be a meta description of that information. And it's like, oh, so what's that mean in terms of a book? I've been thinking of it in terms of nonfiction books. And what I got in touch with the folks who are behind, the scientists there, and they said, you actually have to do an abstraction of each chapter, and we're going to search the description of the chapter, not the chapter itself, as a more efficient way of accessing, getting certain results to searches, to getting accurate results. And that got me thinking more where, okay, yeah, the book itself is meta, but in fact, what the book is about can be described separately from the book itself. So, if you say it's a book about the tragic death of a child and the impact that has on the family and a community, that concept would be difficult to abstract from the book. It never says that exactly in the book, sort of thing. So if people are searching for, books that, represent, a tragic impact on a small community, that might not show up in the data within the book, yet it will show up in the data that's on Amazon, in the description of the book. It will show up in some of the reviews of the book. That language in particular will show up. Mm. All of this by saying, it's pretty complicated. I think from an author's perspective, if anything, the meta that they create of the book itself is done. You wrote the book. That meta exists. If you put it into Google Books, it's searchable and was searchable by Google. So you're already making the meta available. What I think is most important to authors is the external meta instances of the book. And this is why I believe authors need rich websites, because the website becomes the biggest proxy for the finding of a book. It's the place where you can most control the kind of content that you make available. People think about keywords on Amazon, but keywords are really something far broader and should be built in, for example, into the meta headings of a website. So for authors, I think the meta choice is really an elaborate, in-depth strategy that needs to cover off through a lot of different channels.
And everyone's freaking out now because that sounds like a lot of hard work.
Yeah, it might not be quite as hard work. It's getting your mind around it.
Yeah, I agree. But you and I obviously still annoyed about this. And I didn't say this in the notes I sent you, but quantum computing, which I've started to see things about, which I can't explain. I think Justin Trudeau explained it recently. the wonderful Justin. But in terms of where we are now, like you're saying, like even Google has to have a smaller version of the book in order to, do things in a timely manner. But quantum computing, from what I've heard, will change the way calculations are done and the amount of data that can be held. And a shift like that, which seems almost like a big shift, mean that more data could be used in a deeper way. Again, I didn't remind you of this beforehand, but any thoughts on how that kind of shift would change things?
I think that we've seen in computing for a long time that increase in power. There's Moore's law that, every 18 months the processing power doubles, and along the same time the cost of that power goes down by 50%. And that law, some people have argued, is reaching near its technical limit. But then I've been reading other really fascinating papers that show that the rise in computing power is, for all intents and purposes, is limitless. The amount of power that you've got at your disposal with the IBM system, Deep Blue, is so enormous that there's really no problem that even today cannot be addressed by the computing horsepower that anyone has access to. So if ever people are thinking, well, gosh, you know, we have to go through 50,000 books to try and extract a certain kind of data and apply it against a certain question, you can do it. You know, sometimes the computing might run for, you know, 6 or 8 hours, but you can do it. And so the limits become more about formulating the problem that you're trying to solve. I mean, that's that to me is the big thing, is trying to get that kind of intersection. Well, if all of this is possible, and if this is what we're doing now, how do I think about the kinds of issues I'd like to see addressed and then try and map them up against that technology? And that's what I've been going through, working with a couple other people, trying to think about startups in the AI space. It's like, what are the problems that we need to solve? And can AI address those problems?
Oh, now you've mentioned it. Let's talk about your report on publishing startups, looking at innovation in the industry over the past few years. What has survived? What has thrived? And I picked up a couple of ones I wanted to mention. Yesterday in Britain, Hachette bought Bookature, which is one of these big startup digital publishing. There's no details on the money, but this is huge because Bookature was the most successful digital publisher startup in the UK, bought by Hachette. Bonnier launching Type and Tell, a self-publishing platform offering 100% royalties at London Book Fair next week. So Type and Tell, kind of a startup, but by Bonnier, another traditional publisher, off the back of Macmillan, another big publisher, buying Pronoun, a self-publishing platform. So I was fascinated because these are two self-publishing platforms and a digital publishing platform, which are all kind of startups, all being subsumed into big publishing. So coming back to your report, what have you seen that has survived? What's been bought? What's died?
Yes. Well, it's actually great, the ones you just raised, because they are symptomatic of certain things that I saw in the report. Bookature, when I read about that yesterday, it was like, oh, this is interesting. I'll go to my spreadsheet. Is Bookature there? It's not there. How did I miss that one? I've got 900 startups on my spreadsheet. I've been collecting them like a madman for over 5 years now, and some still slip my notice. But then, you know, when I looked more closely at Bookature, I thought, is it in fact a digital publishing startup? They call themselves that, but all they, what was described primarily on the website was that their technology is essentially the same as anybody else's. What they say as their sort of primary distinction is the amount of detail that they put into the editorial, into the design, and certainly into the promotion and the online marketing. And any publisher should be doing that.
You're right.
I think it's that they were acquired by a larger publisher is kind of an admission of failure on their part to have done what they should have done by this time, right? So, but nonetheless, you know, hats off to Bookature, right? They grew very quickly, very successful, smart people. You know, congratulations, that's wonderful. Starting as a self-published service within the aegis of a larger publisher, I mean, there too, it's they should be coming with, you know, very red faces of saying, why didn't we think of this sooner? And we're trying now to kind of apologize with a startup that it will offer all of these royalties. And there they're undermining the, you know, the other large self-publishing services who cannot compete on price, right? Who cannot compete on margin. And so it, from a self-published author's perspective, oh, well, should I go to Pronoun now instead of Smashwords, Lulu, you name it? Yeah, well, the economic decision is yes. And so now it becomes a question of the competition at the infrastructural level. And certainly, you know, those the players that have been playing for a while have really strong, they're plugged in now, they're plugged into library networks, their marketing ideas are quite evolved and so on. But that all of that by saying that there's a continuing evolution in the types of startups that we're seeing and the kind of activity that's engendering in the larger publishing industry. I'll pause there.
Yeah. So, well, I guess, you know, it's interesting because Pronoun started off originally as Vook, I think, back in the day. And Vook, I remember interviewing the guy who started Vook about video video books. That's why it was called Book. You'd got, like, it wasn't an app. It was like a video book, and it was the book, but it had some video in it, and that didn't work. And then they pivoted and did something else, and now pivoted and now I've got Bought, which, you know, just makes me a little bit confused. But I wondered, you know, those are actual like publishing startups, but of the other problem, of course, is marketing. Did you see, and the one I remember, of course, I think we mentioned it last time, is Small Demons, which I liked because it was a kind of, if a book mentions Oxford, here are other books that mention Oxford. It was like a more of a theme and place linking type of discovery engine, which I really liked. So have you seen sort of the marketing startups appearing at all? I mean, Bookature did really well off Facebook ads, but as you say, that shouldn't be anything special. So have there been any special startups that you're really interested in?
The most successful one, is it BookBub that does the free promotions?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, they've turned that into a very solid business. Mm. You know, and so what's the idea of the business? Real simple, a curated selection of free and low-priced ebooks on short-term promotions. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, when that was described as a business plan, people must have, you know, eyes rolled over. But in fact, they executed so well that it's become a coveted, you know, promotional vehicle. There are lots of copycat startups of that. In terms of really innovative ideas, I'm not seeing a heck of a lot. Where you do see an idea, just when you start to get excited about it, you realize that the company's not very well developed, they're not financed, they haven't really thought through how to, you know, execute at scale. And so it's been disappointing to me in a lot of cases. One of the biggest conundrums around these startups is that, you know, anybody can start a website in 24 hours and put it up there and claim that it's, you know, an enabling service. And many, many of these startups are really just about, I call it, you know, sort of good intentions and a website. And what we're hoping to see more of over the next few years is these is companies starting to operate at scale, you know, where there's more than the founders available, you know, by email to reach, where they've worked through some of the problems and figured out how to do the kind of pivot that Vuk had to do before they became successful.
Mm. What about Wattpad? Because of course they've just released Tap in the last week, which is like a really quite cool, if you're a young person, younger than me, where you kind of tap and a new thing appears and you can find a story there. They've got Wattpad Studios now, sort of making films and IP off the back of that. What do you think of Wattpad? Because they're one of the better known startups, I guess.
I call them the poster child because everyone tends to reference Wattpad because they're exciting, right? And they've been hugely successful and they raised a lot of money, nearly $70 million. And I remember when they got the last chunk, which was about $45 million, they said, oh, we don't need the money. We're just putting it in the bank should we need it down the road. And then, but I was watching them and thinking, okay, $70 million, the usual number that we use in terms of what the expectations of the VCs are when they make an investment is that they realistically think they can get a 10 times payout. So they can sell this thing for $700 million, upwards of $1 billion. That's a lot of money. Mm. And so then you look at Wattpad and say, okay, how are you monetizing, using that word, or how are you starting to find ways to attract income? And when as with so many startups that look for scale by attracting users for no cost, you know, they've been hugely successful getting a very large number of users, albeit with, as you imply, a kind of limited demographic. And then you see something like the studio idea and you think, how much money is that going to bring in? You know, what's their cut of the action going to be on that? You know, 100,000 in a really, you know, big instance, if they can get that kind of money. So it points to another problem that you see when you look at my startup report is like, what's the revenue model? They might have a pretty good idea. Wattpad's really interesting and fun and kind of, you know, we're sort of thinking, is this part of the future of publishing? But also, will they be around in 5 years?
Mm. That's really interesting. And I mean, being around in 5 years is something I've been thinking about in terms of Amazon, because in the last week, we've seen a new author earnings report about the dominance of Amazon across, America, UK, Australia, Canada, New Zealand. Amazon won 2 Oscars with Manchester by the Sea.
Yes,
Amazon yes. Prime TV is absolutely massive. At Digital Book World, it was announced that 45% of all book sales are happening digitally, including print sold online, and that Amazon has taken a massive share of that print. There was another thing that said Amazon's own imprint, so Amazon Publishing, is taking up to 50% of the top 20 books on Amazon, Kindle store. So, and Nook, we've seen, is, the revenues are down again. So if you look 5 years ahead, as you say, if things continue as they are, is Amazon going to be the only one left selling anything?
Exactly.
I mean, how do you see that playing out?
I'm frightened, frankly. Mm. Historically, if you look at concentration of corporate power within a particular industry, it reaches a point where it's no longer productive. It becomes counterproductive. It tends to stifle innovation. It restricts the ability of other players to grow within that space. On my blog, whenever I've criticized Amazon, I get deluged by self-published authors who, how dare you?
Sorry.
They've made a huge difference to, and I don't take anything away from them. I think they're brilliant. They execute again and again and again, doing the right things, as you say. There's Netflix, so well established, and Amazon goes in to compete with Netflix, a hugely intelligent company, and already they're succeeding at that as well. And and they're also competing with Apple. I was also surprised in the author earnings report to see how far Apple slipped.
Yeah.
Very low numbers. And you think about that. And
Google's Apple not even on the page. I mean, it's crazy.
Isn't it? It's extraordinary that way, which speaks, both to Amazon's brilliance and to quite a bit of incompetence, one would say, and an undercommitment on the part of those people. But from an author's perspective, I think that this is becoming a problem. I mean, you saw the Kobo numbers, right? Now that was only English language markets. They're still doing pretty well in Canada because of the launch, having started there historically. But that has to be a concern to a self-published author. You look at this situation where, do you only publish on Amazon because they're going to cover off 80% of your sales or more for certain genres? And I think, no, that can't be a good thing. I can't find a way of saying it's better that way than it would be if Amazon was at 50% and we had a strong set of competitors.
Mm, you've got to blame Nook for this as well, because they had a big chunk of the US market and they just let it go. And when they shut down all their international stores, I was just like, I'm sorry, that's crazy. It really annoyed me.
Yeah,
me too. There's just a downward spiral, right?
And you say they let it go. They actually, they neglect would let it go. They were aggressively incompetent. They spent a lot of money ruining their business. They hired a lot of high-priced staff to ruin their business. So it was done not by not paying enough attention. It was done by making a series of catastrophically stupid decisions, such as shutting on the international market.
That was crazy. So it's interesting, because as we're talking about this, it's the week before London Book Fair as we record this, and there's a massive talk about foreign rights being the biggest thing this year. And I'm wondering, is this because people's revenues are falling compared to the Amazon? Everyone's looking at Amazon and going, our revenues are falling from English language sales. So we now have to make this up in the markets where Amazon isn't yet strong. I mean, maybe I'm just making that up, but it kind of feels that way.
That's really interesting. You would say that that author earnings report, my first interpretation of that is that it's a complete condemnation of the rights infrastructure on which so much of commercial publishing is based. And, that's just always been the way, right? That the British publishers, American publishers, they want to sell rights in other territories. Sounds great if you actually sell them. But, it's only for the most popular books that you get a kind of consistent coverage if you're basing your international activities on rights sales. And what the author earnings report shows is that, in fact, to be a self-published author working directly in those marketplaces, you're going to sell a heck of a lot more books than if you're with one of the big five or even similar size publishers, and they're going to get right sales in, you know, maybe they'll get one in UK. Will Australia be an afterthought of that right sale? They'll get France, but not Germany. They'll get, you know, Poland, but not Turkey. This kind of thing is the standard pattern. So for publishers to default to believing that that's the answer or an answer to the current malaise, I don't think it is. The answer to the malaise, as Author Earnings is proving, is to be in your own driver's seat internationally. I think you've proven that with your books. I know that you've got wonderful sales in multiple markets.
But what's interesting is for me now is the translation model. So you mentioned the Google Translate earlier. So I mean, we're looking to license my books into foreign language markets because I tried self-publishing in German and Italian and Spanish, and it just didn't work because I can't market in those languages and there isn't a BookBub, there isn't an ecosystem for marketing as an indie. So we're looking at licensing. But I see this almost as a short-term thing because, as you say, Google Translate. So I have a vision, and we'll come back to augmented reality in a minute, but I have a vision that you just put on your glasses and be able to look at a foreign language text and read it in English or vice versa. So you wouldn't even, you know, are we looking at a future with things like Google Translate, which I haven't tried it, but you could be speaking in French and I could be understanding you in English. Like, it's already that good. Are we looking at that coming into the written and reading and audio in the future, do you think? So we won't even have to do translations.
That's great. Lovely questions. You're thinking about a lot of these things. It's fun to chat. The translation, you know, my first response would be that it's not nearly as good as the hype would have it. And you know, the thing is that you can do a reasonable job pretty easily with the current Google Translate technology. It does not a bad job of a relatively simple document. I think one would look at it and say, yeah, this is 85% as good as if we had a real translator working on it. When it comes to a novel full of nuance, forget it. The translation's nowhere near there. I don't think anyone should be thinking of that on their radar at this point. Javier Saleya in Spain, the consultant there, he's a very, very smart guy. And we were chatting at Digital Book World about the issue of placing books in foreign markets in English language. So selling German, Italy, English language books. And he had a really good idea, which is make sure that you translate all of the associated marketing material. Makes sense as soon as he said it, you know, that you're in Germany. Yes, you're able to read English and you're interested in English language books, but far better you get the description in your own language, that your first encounter with that book is going to be in your own language. But he pointed out that, you know, this is the thing that was like, yeah, zing, metadata, keywords. Yeah, keywords in another language are going to be different keywords than the ones you would use, you know, in English. Using English keywords, in Germany makes no sense whatsoever. They're going to be searching on in their own language for keywords. That's how books are going to surface. I don't think Amazon allows that. Onyx does. If you use the Onyx, you know, metadata structure, you can do that.
You can. I did that with mine. You just put in, I got my translator to give me the words. So she did the search and you can just put them in. But the difficulty was just, you know, there isn't the infrastructure in the book promotional sense, like, you know, like a BookBub in German, for example. But that's probably a pick for the next 5 years, is that this ecosystem in translation has to mature a bit more in the self-publishing space.
Yes. When you change the metadata into German, for example, are you able to list separately on Amazon Germany so that metadata is ingested separately from English metadata?
Well, when you upload a German book, so it has to be a separate book. So I'm talking about, but yeah, I know what you mean. So you're saying an English language book using German metadata. That's a really good, yes. And this is one of the problems we have is that you have to publish one book once, otherwise you get a copyright notice. So I would love to have a different cover in America than in Britain because we have such different tastes in yes. covers and that's why publishers do it. But yes. at the moment we all have only one method to publish globally. Yep. So I think these things are going to definitely change in the next few years. So I also wanted to ask you, like, in terms of exciting things that are happening, one thing you and I did not see coming last time was the rise of Alexa. And I'm going to say her name live now. I was stopping, but they're releasing a voice recognition update. So hopefully my voice won't trigger anyone listening on her. So right. yeah, so Amazon's in-home device, and we have one and it's awesome. And Google Home, of course, and Apple has Siri. But Alexa over last Christmas just went nuts, right? And it's in millions of homes. And I'm excited about the rise of audiobooks and also any yes. kind of voice-activated technologies, stories, things that we just haven't even thought of yet. So what are your thoughts around Alexa and AI and how that can help publishing?
Great fun, first of all, right? We're having a lot of fun with these. The voice recognition, yeah. We chatted before the call or emailed before this call. You know, I've been frustrated with voice recognition technology over the years. And, you know, I use Dragon Naturally Speaking, and it's up to version 15 and finally has got it. You know, you now get about a 99% accuracy rate on translation, on voice dictation. And that's something I've been working with that software for 15 years. I was thinking I've probably given them $2,000 in upgrade fees over the years, and none of it quite worked. So by the time you get a Siri and Alexa, we still have to address some of the quality issues. And you know, what makes Dragon work is that there's a training module, and none of the other off-the-shelf recognitions allow you to do the training. And so you take a big hit in the accuracy. So that's the first thing. But then I'm being a part party pooper if I say that. So let's say it is wonderful. It works beautifully. I think you're hitting nail on the head. I mean, this is when we think of the future of publishing, it's going to be enabled by technologies that are coming out of some other field. And you're thinking, you know, people are thinking of Alexa being able to help them with their shopping. And you're thinking, you know, in far more exciting ways, somewhere at the intersection of book publishing, audiobooks, voice recognition, we're going to be seeing new ways of delivering content that, if nothing else, will promote the book, but even better, will become another revenue stream, another opportunity for authors to rethink the way they deliver to readers.
I'm just super excited about it. But then you and I get excited about these geeky things anyway, don't
we? Yeah, we do.
Even if it don't work out.
Can't help it.
I know. It's so cool. I love talking to you because I can just geek out and people can just turn off if they're not interested. Which is fun. But the other thing, I've just finished this book, The Fourth Transformation, How Augmented Reality and Artificial Intelligence Will Change Everything by Robert Scoble and Shel Israel. And what they basically talk about is this shift from handheld devices and the sort of head down approach into a typing into a screen or talking into a screen to the head up approach of glasses. Now, moving on from Google Glass, you know, which was a bit of a failure, it was a bit too early. They're talking about Magic Leap, which is still under wraps. I mean, right. But what they've sort of said with the patents and things, and Apple as well, coming out with things that just look like, you know, normal glasses and are augmented reality or mixed reality. So you can see a layer on top of the world. It's not like virtual reality where you put on a headset and disappear. It's more that you're using it to see on top of the world. And that to me is very exciting. You know, first of all, like, just think about coming to digital book world as we do and seeing people's Twitter handles above their heads, seeing people's names. I mean, how useful would that be just on a basic yes. level? And then yes. I was thinking, like, I would like to record myself walking around London. And then if you're in London, you could turn on my recording and I could guide you around my London where I, you know, have my book set and everything. So you get like a personalized tour through your headset, but you're still walking through London. So you get that on top. So I'm just so excited about this. What do you think about augmented reality and this kind of level?
It's great to hear you talk about it. Your enthusiasm is wonderful. Your ideas make a whole lot of sense too. And when I think of the question, there's two sides. Let's start on the real upside. I've been working on the future of publishing for a long time now. And when these startups that I did in the report, the 900 startups, I look at them and I say, where's the innovation in these? Where's the real innovation? I'm seeing a little bit of incremental idea changes, but the real innovation. On the other hand, the ones who have tried to innovate most dramatically have failed so far. And what we've seen is that let's think back for a moment to the enhanced ebook, right? And that was a no-go, right? There's a few of them that succeeded, but TouchPress, the best developer of them, they had to abandon, and they were hugely successful in terms of number of units moved. They couldn't make the economics of it work, something's going to, right? When I present to people on the competition to book publishing for these startups, the competition's not other startups in the publishing space. It's the fact that people are becoming more and more attuned to audio and video stimuli, let's say, than they are to the written word. The written word is becoming quite flat for a lot of people. That's been, sort of cautioned for a long time, but I think it wasn't when we used to worry about the decline of print, we were more worried that it was becoming less interesting. I think what we learned is print hasn't become any less interesting. If anything, it's far more interesting because of writers like yourself who can tell wonderful stories and grab people and do continuous work within the genre, put out a lot of material. So it's far more compelling than ever. But over here, video, the transformation in video, in music, in the way these things are delivered is so much more profound. And what book publishers, authors need to figure out again is, as with the voice recognition, how is this going to intersect? And how can we make this intersect? Probably we should be looking at it from the point of view of someone who understands VR, virtual reality, for example, and doesn't know about book publishing. They can come to it fresh. We bring too much baggage in our thinking about what makes book publishing. I think it makes it hard for people to see some of the opportunities here. Having said all of that, again, the cautionary note, right? When I was thinking about us chatting, I was thinking last night and thinking, 3D glasses, how's that working out for you? And there's a technology that's been around for quite a few years, and it had these various renaissance, and currently supposedly is in some sort of renaissance, but is already being dropped by a lot of directors. And so and what went wrong with that? They don't want to put something on their face, apparently, it's a very simple usability issue that, as long as there's something that they have to wear that's, that only is a single purpose tool, it's not going to take off. So with VR, we're going to have to look to Apple and the Magic startup and to see some real innovation that allows us to use existing devices in some sort of augmented fashion.
I think what's interesting in that book, The Fourth Transformation, which I really recommend people read if they're interested in this next level, is that Magic Leap is really under wraps, as they say, but some of the people who've seen it are some of the most senior people in these tech industries, and they're calling it the first $1 billion industry straight out the gate, as in it's kind of going to reinvent the way the internet. So I mean, like you say, lots of hyperbole, but very interesting potential. Like if we talk again in 18 months, which I hope we will, then we'll be like, okay, has this happened or not? They're saying it's around 2023. So it's interesting to see how fast it will happen. So I know we could talk forever, but I'm very wary of time, but I want to just go to a completely different level. And again, I didn't put this in our notes, but thinking about what India has just done, which is digitalize their currency. And move to micropayments. So what we've got is one of the biggest, most populated countries in the world, where so many people are rural, they don't have bank accounts, they don't have a physical address, and they're moving to micropayments on cell phone devices because that's what people have. They don't have a home necessarily, but they have a cell phone. So they're digitizing the economy, and the stuff I've been reading on in Wired magazine about the way they're digitizing the economy, this is apparently reinventing the blockchain, going even further than Bitcoin. Now, for me as a independent author, I want in on India. I want in on sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America. And to me, micropayments, the kind of 0.0001 rupee per page read of the whatever billion people in India, that's what I want in on. So here's, you know, the complete radical shift. Could we see a way where we publishing could shift to these micropayment models, which the music industry is too, with the streaming, you know, people are getting these micropayments. So this is another idea that's exciting me, but any thoughts on that?
We've been hoping for micropayments for a long time because it does solve a big problem, you know, in terms of how do you get a subset of your content, how do you get remunerated for some subset of your content, and the micropayment makes sense in that way. It's interesting, you know, but we haven't been able to make a system like that work in the Western world. India, you know, is a hotbed of innovation with very unique demographic challenges, and it's perfect that the market is moving in that direction. Yes, the blockchain technology can enable that, and then you know, Apple Pay becomes part of the play in that, and it's you can start to imagine that the seamless mechanism for micropayments may be a possibility in the next few years. Everything that's happened with micropayments has fallen again on usability. You know, you had to go through too many steps to allocate the payment and register and, you know, decide where the payment was going and what the amount was going to be. So that what that comes up against is but coming back to the subscription model. And the book there that I found intriguing is Kevin Kelly's The Inevitable.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. Yeah.
It's fun. And Kevin makes a really good point where he says, you know, it's around the sort of Spotify model. But he talks about books specifically. And he said, you know, I don't need to own them anymore. You know, like that paradigm for a man who's, you know, in his 70s and has owned books all his life and loves books and written a lot of books. I don't need to own them anymore. I'm happy to have them in the cloud. And I don't need to. The other thing that was, you know, related to that is when I hear about a new book, our mode right now is, okay, I heard about a new book, sounds good, I'll go, I'll buy it, I'll download it. And he's like, well, but if I know it's in the cloud, I don't have to do that. You know, I can keep track, keep reading the books I'm reading, knowing that, you know, if a couple of weeks from now I'm still interested, it's there for me. I don't have to have made that transaction. So you get the streaming of books, and that to him is inevitable, as per the title of the book. And I think about that, and I think, you know, the subscription model, I had 19 in my startup list. There's 19 different companies that started up to try and tackle the subscription problem. All of them, except for Scribd, has gone. And which has been very telling. And the book publishers don't show any kind of willingness around the copyright issues to enable a subscription. But if you're Kevin Kelly, it's inevitable. And that's how I see solving the micropayments is via the Spotify model, where there will be the agency that does the microtransactions but aggregates the transfer of wealth.
Yeah, and I'm definitely aiming for that. I mean, again, I think as indie authors and as sort of being able to pivot and take advantage of global things, without, you know, the big publishers take ages to take advantage of this stuff. Whereas if we can get in early, like I'm talking, actually, I should email you separately about this, but I'm talking to a guy in the Netherlands who has a startup doing secondhand ebook sales.
Yes, that's been around for a while. Yeah. Not that startup, but that idea.
Exactly. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. And Kobo's just launched Kobo Plus in the Netherlands, which is a subscription model. So there's something in the Netherlands that means people aren't buying books, clearly. And maybe it's pricing, but maybe they're just, you know, maybe, yeah, prices are too high. So there's other ways. But I definitely see that there has to be a shift in this type of model over the next few years. So anyway, I've taken up so much of your time, but it's always...
otherwise.
Awesome to talk to you, Thad. So tell people where they can find all your stuff online.
Everything's at thefutureofpublishing.com. And this report that I do recommend people read it. It's, you know, it's kind of fun. It gives you a kind of, oh gosh, I would never have thought 900 of them. Anyway, that's for download right on the homepage. And you'll see a blog. My latest blog entry describes it and also talks about the machine learning things we've been discussing. Those are my last two blogs. Couple blog entries ago as well. So there's some stuff there that people might enjoy.
Thanks so much for your time, Thad. That was great.
Oh, I really enjoy it, Joanna.
So I hope you enjoyed the geeky episode with Thad, and I'll look forward to having him back on the show in sort of 18 months time, and you know, how things will change over that period. It's always really interesting to see whether we're just totally way ahead of the game, or whether things that, you know, will come out the blue, like the Alexa, for example. So this week, remember, you can join Brian Cohen and me for our free webinar this Thursday, 13th of April, 2017. Check out all the details at thecreativepen.com/Brian17. And next week on the show, we are launching American Demon Hunters Sacrifice. And the show will have three separate mini interviews, so three short interviews, with Lindsay Baroka, who made seven figures in 2016 from her writing, Jay Thorne, who is the king of collaboration, and Zach Bohannon, who has recently quit his job to go full-time as a writer. And I basically gave Zach, poor old Zach, I gave him a wine-fueled kick up the behind in New Orleans. So go, Zach, and... apparently he needed it, but afterwards I felt a little guilty. I'd had a few glasses of wine and I was like, why don't you should just give up your job and it will be fine. And it was a bit more in depth than that, obviously. But yeah, anyway, well done, Zach. I recorded these three little interviews during the week in New Orleans in the hotel room while we were still doing the collaboration. So you're going to hear how they each thought the collaboration was going, as well as talking about what's working for them right now in terms of marketing and what they're excited about as indies. Plus, I'll be telling you all the amazing bonuses that you can get if you buy Sacrifice in launch week, which is next week, week of the 17th to 24th of April. Even if you don't want to read it, you're going to want to buy it anyway, because you'll get a whole load of bonuses, plus a chance to win a consulting call with me. And I don't even do consulting anymore, but that's one of the possible prizes. Also, you can get a consulting call with Lindsay, Zach, or Jay. Also get on Lindsay's podcast, and also get the co-writing book and a whole load of bonus fiction. So definitely listen to the show next week, and I will see you then. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.